Chapter 3, Part 2, The Yoga of Action, Verses 21 through 24.
Yad yad acharati shreshtas tatta deveta rojanaha, sayat pramanam kurute lokas tadanu vartate. Name parthasti kartavyam trishu lokeshu kinchana, nana vaptam avaptavyam varta evacha karmani. Yadi hyaham na varteyam jatu karmanya tandritaha, mama vartmanu vartante manushya partha sarvashaha. Utsi deyu rime loka nakuryam karma chedaham, sankarasya cha kartasyam upahanyami mahaprajaha.
In whatever way the senior most one conducts himself, that very way the other people follow. Whatever authority he establishes, the world conducts itself accordingly. O son of Pritha, in all the three worlds I have nothing that is yet to be done, nothing not attained or yet to be attained, yet I indeed continue in action. If I were perchance not to continue in action without lassitude, O son of Pritha, and since all human beings follow my path in every way, all these worlds would perish if I were not to perform action. I would be the cause of disorder, and would kill all these beings. In all the great cultures of the world, there has always been the noble tradition of following in the footsteps of the great ones. They are accepted as great because of their selflessness and the sacrifices they made for the people who came in touch with them. Thus they became examples and ideals for ordinary people. A great man is known by certain signs and symptoms that are not found in ordinary people. Ordinary people are selfish. Great men are selfless. The minds of ordinary people are uncontrolled and disturbed, whereas the minds of great men are controlled and tranquil. Ordinary people cannot visualize future events, but great men can have such vision. There are two kinds of great people that we hold up as ideals. First, there are the fortunate ones who completely devote their lives to prayer and meditation. Then, there are those who know how to live in the world, doing their duties selflessly and offering the fruits of their actions to others. Both are worthy of our reverence. The action, speech, and behavior of the great ones are observed by ordinary people who then follow such great people without any doubts. If by chance the conduct of a great man is no longer exemplary, there is the chance for such conduct to be magnified by the masses in a horrible and exaggerated way. Those who follow the path of selfless service therefore remain austere, so that their image is not distorted, and thus does not lead others to disappointment and disgust. Ordinary people have in their hearts and minds an image of what a great man should be like. If the person who is idealized as a hero, leader, or great man does not live according to the image projected onto him by the masses, the revered symbol that they have created for the great man is also destroyed. Sometimes it is the fault of the idealized person, but many times it is due to the false expectations of his following. For instance, before a student comes to meet a spiritual teacher for the first time, he has already formed ideas and impressions about what a teacher should be like. When he goes to the teacher, it disappoints him if the teacher does not talk, sit, and behave the way he expects. He then searches for another teacher that will meet his ideal, but he is not successful in that endeavor, for the student has created an image within and expects the teacher to live according to the projection of his own inner ideal. A similar process occurs between a patient and his psychotherapist. The distortions projected onto the therapist are called transference. Teachers also have certain expectations. They want to meet the perfect student. Both teachers and students become disappointed with each other's actual behavior, but when they keep their minds open and free from preconceived ideas, they can accept each other as they are. It is important to distinguish between the image that the student projects onto the teacher and the qualities that are prerequisites of a good teacher. A student should not accept a teacher unless he has the following qualities. 1. A teacher should be selfless. 2. All his expressions should be loving, and there should not be greed of any sort from the teacher's side. 3. A teacher should not use his students to serve him in any way, for that makes the teacher dependent on his students. One who is dependent on someone else's resource is not a genuine teacher and should not be followed. 4. A real teacher is never tired of teaching his students. He teaches in many ways, through his speech, writings, and actions, and at a later stage, through silence. If those signs and symptoms are missing in the teacher, one should not waste his time and energy following him. Instead of learning and listening to the teacher's instructions, many students foolishly start adoring and worshiping him as though he were a god. Such teachers and students destroy the noble heritage of the teacher-disciple relationship and create confusion for the real seekers and teachers. Analyzing and studying symbols is one of the profound ways of knowing the qualities of great men. In ancient times, there were no printing presses, tape recorders, or writing paper. Therefore, the ancients left certain symbols for future generations so that they could understand the way the ancients lived. For example, if the pictorial symbol of Ganapati, the elephant god, is properly understood and analyzed, it becomes clear that the ancients described the ideal qualities of a leader through that symbol. The head of an elephant symbolizes that a great leader should not be violent, for elephants are very calm. They do not live on the flesh of other beings. Elephants are vegetarians, and they are both healthy and intelligent. Using an elephant as an example dispels the notion that it is necessary to eat meat in order to maintain health and vigor. Ganapati has a big belly, which means the leaders should be able to accept all sorts of suggestions from various quarters for the sake of doing justice and selfless service to society. Ganapati is shown with a mouse, meaning that leaders should have counselors like mice who, with the help of their sharp teeth, can cut the net of entanglements and conspiracy that tend to develop around leaders. There are many other aspects of this symbol, Ganapati, that one can learn from. But today, instead of understanding the symbolism, many people worship the symbol without knowing its meaning. There are many other symbols, such as the cross, the Star of David, and the lotus, that are adored and worshipped without knowing their meanings. That is a serious error. The method of understanding such symbolism is a knowledge in itself, like the method of studying dream symbols. It should be studied if one is to understand the world within and without. Sri Krishna instructs Arjuna to live up to the estimation of a great man, for he is a leader and warrior. And if he fails in doing his duties, the ordinary people will follow his example, and the entire organization of the society will become disintegrated, degenerated, and disturbed. The way great people behave is the very way ordinary people try to behave. The standards laid down by the great men become ideals for laymen to follow. The great ones actually have nothing to do, no action or duty whatsoever. They perform actions only in the service of humanity. They have no selfish motivation. Sri Krishna declares that in all three worlds there is nothing for him to do. What are those three worlds? The world that is known by the ordinary person is a reality created by the senses and mind when one is in the waking state. In the dreaming state, that reality is completely changed, and in the sleeping state, it vanishes. The mind functions differently in each of these three states, and has different experiences in each. These three states of mind are like three distinct realities. The mind functions even in deep sleep, and that subtle functioning of the mind is beyond the realm of the waking and dreaming states. When the mind is trained to go beyond the spheres of these three states, it experiences a state called Turiya, which can be termed sleepless sleep, a fully awakened state from which one can have a profound and comprehensive knowledge of the waking, dreaming, and sleeping realities. A great one who has attained the state beyond has nothing left to be done in any of the three worlds experienced in the waking, dreaming, and sleeping states. Sri Krishna is a traveler through the three worlds, having his permanent abode in the fourth, where both actions and the fruits received therein lose their value and meaning. One is not motivated to do duties or actions when he has already accomplished the purpose of his life, for the desire that motivates him to actions is absent in the state beyond. Here, cause and effect, which are inseparably mingled, remain completely absent, for motivation and desire are already fulfilled. Their values and influences are reduced to zero. Therefore, no duty whatsoever remains to be performed. Sri Krishna is leading Arjuna to fathom all three levels of consciousness, waking, dreaming, and sleeping, and finally, to attain the state of tranquility so that he can have a clear and comprehensive view of all three realities. When consciousness is trapped by the deluded mind, the vision is obscured. Partial vision creates further confusion. The confused mind loses its power and does not have awareness of the other dimensions of life. Arjuna is aware only of one state of mind. Influenced by the dramas taking place in the waking state, he does not have profound knowledge of the whole. Sri Krishna, the Lord and Master of all the states of consciousness, advises, "Rise and go higher and higher, and finally attain the state of tranquility." After the three worlds are explained, one wonders why a fully realized person, having perfect tranquility and being completely non-attached, wants to perform action. That question is answered in verse 24. All social institutions function because of the particular order established by the leaders. If the leaders do not perform actions to help the masses, the entire society will be disintegrated and destroyed. Many great civilizations have vanished from the earth because the leaders failed to perform their duties. According to the times and needs of society, great men have come to guide the masses. Though the great men are free from motivations that prompt them to do their duties, they walk on earth with us exactly like ordinary human beings, but with extraordinary skill in performing actions to lead, help, and educate the masses. It is not because they have a need to do that, but because of their love for others. Sri Krishna is implicitly saying, "O Arjuna, you are also a great leader, and if you abandon your duty, that will lead to the destruction of your people. At this critical juncture, do not shy away, but fight the battle." There are three categories of great people. There are those who are great by birth, for they have already accomplished all they ought to have accomplished in their previous births. They come to this world with a desire to serve, love, and give. The second group of great people makes serious efforts to attain greatness. In their human effort and endeavor, they sometimes slip, yet they are great compared to ordinary people. The third category of great people is composed of those who are made great by publicity and propaganda. That form of greatness misleads the masses and destroys their human endeavor. Unfortunately, in a country like ours, every year there comes a Bhagavan, Guru, or self-proclaimed Avatara who gains notoriety, though he actually has none of the qualities of a truly great man. Such Bhagavans mislead others and become a curse to the innocent students who follow them blindly. Arjuna belongs in the second category. Sri Krishna instructs Arjuna to do his duty, for he is a leader, and his behavior will be observed and followed by the masses. Verses 25 and 26.
Sakta karmanya vidvamso yatha kurvanti bharata, kuryad vidvams tatha saktis chikirshur lokasangraham. Na buddhi bhedam janayet agnyanam karma sanginam, doshayet sarva karmani vidvan yuktas samacharan.
O descendant of Bharata, whatever the unwise do attached to action, that very thing a wise one, desirous of gathering worldly success, should do without attachment. One should not divert the minds of the ignorant who are attached to action. A wise man who conducts himself joined in yoga should let them learn how to perform actions lovingly. Ordinary people become attached to their duties and the fruits received therein, but wise is he who selflessly performs his duties for the welfare of humanity. Because of his attachment, the ordinary person has no vision of the horizon of the infinite and suffers on account of that limitation. He is always afraid of giving up what he has, and without giving, one cannot receive. Giving and sacrificing are one and the same act. Great men know only giving, which motivates them to perform their duties for the benefit of mankind. In all social orders of the world, ordinary people follow the great men. The great man, therefore, should not divert the minds of those who are performing their duties, but should help them to learn how to do actions skillfully. He should lead them to the level of consciousness in which duties done without attachment lead to emancipation. Students and clients complain, "My duties make me feel trapped. How can I become free? Shall I remain in the situation that I am in, or shall I change the situation?" For example, a woman says, "My duties to my husband and children have made me a slave." The answer is that it is necessary to perform one's duties, but if we do not learn to create love for the duties that we have assumed, we will be doing them mechanically, without experiencing joy. For those who learn to love their duties and make all possible efforts, the same duties that once created bondage then begin creating happiness. Love is strengthened by giving and thwarted by expectation. While doing duties, just give and you will receive joy. But if you have the expectation of receiving love in return, and the other person from whom you are expecting also expects, these two expectations will clash, injuring the feelings of both parties. Expectation is not love, but the source of misery. If selfless giving is missing in the close relationship between husband and wife, the family institution crumbles, because the family is intended to radiate love selflessly. Because selflessness is absent, we see misery at home, outside, and all over. The wise person does not abruptly introduce ideas that are beyond the comprehension of ordinary people, but he lovingly helps them to understand without hurting them and brings them home gently. All profound teachings are imparted by great people with love and gentleness. Forced teachings and instructions abruptly imparted are either ineffective or create aversion. We see that happening all the time between parents and children. Whenever the parents are abrupt, though they have good intentions, they make rebels out of their loving children, and that creates a huge gulf in communication. Higher teachings can be intellectually imparted by anyone with the help of the scriptures, but such teachings are not assimilated in the minds and hearts of the students, for they lack the warmth of love and gentleness. But a good teacher imparts the teachings with love and gentleness in his unique way. Such a skill is rarely found. Those who have patience, tolerance, selfless love, gentleness, and inner strength are careful not to abruptly introduce or impose their ideas on others. It is an art that is not taught through books, but learned through experience and interaction. One might meet many intellectuals and scholars who can recite the scriptures by heart, but how often does one meet someone who imparts knowledge through love? Sri Krishna, by his own example and instruction, is teaching Arjuna to perform his duties with selfless love, and to be an example for others. Verses 27 and 28.
ప్రకృతే క్రియమాణాని గుణైః కర్మాణి సర్వశః అహంకార విమూఢాత్మా కర్తాహం ఇతి మన్యతే. తత్వవిత్తు మహాబాహో గుణకర్మ విభాగయోః గుణాగుణేషు వర్తంత ఇతి మత్వా న సజ్జతే.
With regard to the actions being performed by the gunas of prakriti, jointly and severally, one whose nature is confused by ego believes, I am the agent of action. He, however, who knows the reality of the divisions of gunas and actions, O mighty armed one, knows the gunas are interacting with gunas. Knowing this, he does not become attached. Let us examine whether the human being alone is responsible for his actions and their consequences. Human beings are in a position to function more independently and profoundly than the animal and plant kingdoms and the kingdom of inanimate objects. The human being is uniquely privileged to act independently, whereas the animal kingdom is completely controlled by nature. There is no free will for animals. But the human being has free will and intelligence, which make him stand apart from the animal kingdom. Actions like eating, sleeping, procreation, and those stemming from the urge for self-preservation are found equally in both the human and animal kingdoms. Those are the actions performed by nature. However, the human being alone has the inherent capacity to perform actions without being controlled by the basic urges. His willpower and intelligence give him the ability to understand, analyze, and control the motivations, desires, thoughts, and emotions that are finally translated into action. He has the power to change the course of the whole chain of events from motivation to desire to thought to action. He can be aware of each aspect of the process that leads him to act, and with proper training, he can modify any part of it. Even though he uses his inherent capacity to regulate and modify his actions, the human being is not really the doer of his actions. All actions are actually performed by the governing nature of the universe called prakriti. The self, seated unattached and unaffected in the inner chamber of one's being, always maintains its tranquility with all its glory and majesty. It is only the ego that leads the human being to think and feel that he is the doer, the performer of actions, and that he has the right to reap the fruits of his actions. Here, there is a subtle point to be understood. Anyone who becomes a doer also becomes the receiver of the fruits of his actions. One's false sense of doing and reaping creates misery for him, and he suffers on account of his self-created misery. The ego thus needs to be purified and trained not to identify itself as the doer, but to remain a witness by being conscious of the true self, which exists eternally with its immortal and splendid nature. The ego is one of four main functions in our internal organization. Our internal organization is like that of a workshop, and the ego is the representative of the real self. When the ego forgets the real self, when it forgets that it is only a representative, it creates serious problems of confusion and delusion within the internal organization. It does not counsel with the other aspects of the internal organization, and thus loses control over the aspect of mind, manas, that functions both inside and outside, and which is actually the main instrument of both perception and conception. When the ego shakes off its false vanity and remembers its role, then it does not create bondage, and barriers that stand between the aspirant and the real self, the source of consciousness and knowledge. Egoism creates great suffering for the human being, but the wise person does not allow his ego to create obstacles for his growth. He knows that, in fact, actions are performed by prakriti, the universal nature. Therefore, he is free from such deluded conceptions as, I have a desire to do, I want to do, I am going to do, or I have done. Prakriti has three qualities called gunas. Those three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, are distinct from one another yet function together. Actually, all actions performed by any aspect of nature are led by these three qualities or gunas. The qualities of each object are different from one another. So when two objects come into contact, there is a confrontation, and as a result, they either unite and thereby create something new, or they create conflict. In this way, the gunas are the source of action in the universe. These three qualities exist together in the human being, as well as in every aspect of nature. But when one of them becomes predominant, one's actions take on the quality of the predominant guna. A deed performed in a state of tranquility is a consequence of sattva guna. The deed in which rajas is predominant is performed with a desire to reap the fruits. Tamas leads one to sloth, and thus to inaction. No one can remain without doing action, but when one does action with an inert mind, there is no concentration. Therefore, there is total disintegration and chaos. By studying and understanding these verses, we can realize that we are mistaken to feed our egos, deluding ourselves that we are doing great deeds or serving humanity. A child plucks a beautiful flower and hands it to his mother, saying, "Here, Mommy, I am giving this to you," as though the gift comes from him. But the gift of the flower was created by nature, out of the gunas, and the child, also motivated by the gunas, is merely transporting it from one place to another, though claiming that it is his to give. The ego, being the predominant part of the internal organization, is deluded by its false identification with the qualities of the self. It believes that it, the ego, is all-powerful and all-knowing, and that creates the bondage. But when one shakes loose all the fetters by becoming aware of the eternal, freedom is attained. Modern psychologists have also asserted that the human being does not perform actions, but acts at the mercy of the forces of nature. In fact, that is the great insight of modern psychology, which in part arose as a reaction to the rationalistic popular philosophies that preceded it. Such philosophies held that man acts out of his own irrational choices. The behaviorists, however, believe that the human being is moved by habits that are established by reward and punishment. Freud argued that the conscious mind is just a small part of the mind, and that human beings are predominantly moved by unconscious forces. Jung and the archetypal psychologists go a step further and dramatically assert that man is not the doer of his actions. Their view is in agreement with these verses, which are difficult to understand at first, for we consistently think of ourselves as the initiators of our actions, even though we see other forms of life at the mercy of and reacting automatically to internal and external forces outside of their control. Jung and the archetypal psychologists attempt to show that the archetypes, which exist at deeper layers of the unconscious, are continually engaged in ritualistic dramas that are universal and repeated again and again throughout the generations. The conscious person, they say, is merely an onlooker to these grand and glorious dramas, rather than the actor. Verse 29.
Prakriter guna sammoodhaah sajjante guna karmasu tana krishna vido mandan krishnavin navichalaye.
Those who are confused by the gunas of Prakriti become attached to the actions of the gunas. One who knows the complete reality should not cause conflict in the minds of the dull-witted, little-knowing ones. Ordinary people who are deluded by identifying with the qualities of Prakriti vainly conclude that they are the performers and doers of the actions. Such ignorant ones think that way, desiring to enjoy the fruits of their actions. The person who knows and is able to dispel the cloud of ignorance should be very careful not to do anything that would cause conflict in the minds of ordinary people. Sri Krishna advises Arjuna not to be a bad example, deluded by the sense of ego, and not to mislead the masses. A leader who has not disciplined himself is unable to lead the masses in the right direction. A leader should have perfect discipline. Otherwise, instead of serving the masses, he can mislead them. Verse 30.
Mayi sarvani karmani sanyasyadhyatma chetasa nirashir nirmamo bhutva yudhyasva vigatajvaraha.
With your mind centered on the self, dedicating all actions to me, free of expectation and free of the thought, mine, fight without the fever of fear and anxiety. He alone who has learned to direct all his energies and the power of his thoughts, emotions, and desires to attain the knowledge of the self has freedom. The common man remains conscious only of the world of objects, but those who are conscious of the self-existent reality direct all their energy inward with a one-pointed desire to attain immortality. Ordinary people are ignorant because of their outward desires. The objects of the external world constantly lead one to identify with the changing phenomena and to forget the nature of the self, which is unchanging and everlasting. Sri Krishna therefore says, O Arjuna, dedicate all of your actions with a one-pointed mind focused on the highest self with no expectation or attachment whatsoever. Without fear and anxiety, fight the battle of life. This verse talks of dedicated action, which actually is prayer in action. When we pray but cannot dedicate our actions, that prayer is not of much use. Dedicating all of our actions and the fruits we receive therein is higher than the prayer that is uttered by our lips. The poems and hymns we utter are not as profound or as important as dedication of the fruits of our actions. There are two kinds of people. One praises God all the time. The other remains silent and performs his actions, dedicating all the fruits of his actions to the Lord. It is clear that the latter prayer is superior to the former. Verses 31 and 32.
Ye me matamidam nitya manutishthanti manavaha saddhavanto nasuyanto muchyante tepi karmabhi dyetvetadabhyasuyanto nanutishthanti me matam sarvajnana vibhudhanstan viddhi nashtana chetasah.
Those children of Manu who ever steadfastly follow this teaching of mine, filled with faith and without malice, they are even freed through those very actions. Those, however, who are critical and do not observe this teaching of mine, know them, confused concerning all knowledge, to be mindless who perish. Sri Krishna teaches that all actions are performed by nature. He says to Arjuna, therefore, shun the idea that you are a doer. Remain detached from the sense of being a doer and be an example for others, for the ordinary people always follow their leaders. Ignorant are those who perform actions thinking that they are the doers, but those who know that all actions are performed by Prakriti and understand the mystery of all three gunas remain free. In these verses, Sri Krishna says, those who follow my teachings with full faith rejoice in their life on earth. Faith is a word that has been repeatedly used by religionists. The expression have faith is a common one, but faith has many meanings. It may mean do not argue, do not use your mind, but just follow me blindly. But here, the term faith does not have the same meaning as when it is used by preachers and priests while giving sermons in the temples and churches. Sraddha, faith, implies that apart from the knowledge received from the mind, there is yet another avenue still undiscussed and unknown. That avenue opens spontaneously if one knows how to keep his mind from intervening in that spontaneity. A sadhaka wants to have faith, but all sorts of doubts created by the mind do not allow him to have faith. Faith is not the product of the mind, but something living that is experienced by opening the path of the heart that leads to the dawning of spiritual love and intuition. Many great sages attain a state of ecstasy by using the power of emotion, it being higher than the power of thought. If the power of emotion is directed with a full heart, one is able to attain that knowledge which is never experienced by the mind. The mind is like a small ruler, and human beings like to measure the universe with the help of this small measuring stick. The power of emotion, however, opens one to another higher channel of knowledge, which is called intuition. There are three main channels of knowledge: intuition, intellect, and instinct. Intuition, the highest channel of knowledge, is self-evident and does not need support of any kind. The door to that knowledge opens with the power of emotion, bhava, and not through mental gymnastics. In verse 31, the path of faith and devotion is being introduced to Arjuna. Many students who cannot follow the path of selfless action are led to follow the path of faith, love, and devotion. In these verses, Sri Krishna opens that channel of knowledge, stressing that the aspirant must have faith in the wisdom imparted by the great teachers. He declares, "Have faith and follow, for the teachings expounded by me are free from error." Here, Sri Krishna for the first time exercises his authority with profound certainty in order to lead his beloved student deeper. Often, when a student enters into an argument or debate, he forgets that his teacher is teaching not only on the basis of scriptural knowledge, but also from his experience of that knowledge. Though we have many experiences every day, those experiences do not always guide us. But the inner experience that has been attained directly is the best guide and instructor, and should be followed with full faith without any doubt. There are many steps that a disciple must fathom in relating to his competent teacher. The teacher never gives such instructions as are given in these verses at the first instance of the meeting with his disciple, but only when the communication between the teacher and student is well established. There is a prayer that is used even today before the teacher imparts the knowledge of the divine. May he protect us both, teacher and student. May he lead us both to enjoy the bliss of liberation. May we both make efforts to realize the truth of the scriptures. May our studies bear fruit. May we never quarrel with each other. Before this teaching was imparted, Sri Krishna and Arjuna had a long discussion, and like any other student, Arjuna argued. There comes a stage when one goes through a period of argumentation, and this state of mind should not be shunned until all the doubts are resolved. Then the state free from all doubts leads one to another channel of knowledge, intuition. We have already said that there are three channels of knowledge. The path of pure reason, buddhi, is followed by the fortunate few. The path of buddhi yoga is used by those aspirants who are intellectually oriented for performing duties in the world, and also by yogis to control the senses, turn the mind inward, and to finally resolve all questions. Intellectuals, however, use the mind by employing their senses externally with the desire to enjoy pleasures. They are lost in the world of pleasures, whereas yogis attain the state of equilibrium, remaining non-attached and unaffected by the external world, and performing their duties skillfully. But among all the channels of knowledge, intuition is the purest of all. And for receiving that knowledge, the mind is not used. The power of emotion is evoked, and thus intuitive knowledge is received. The third channel of knowledge is also valid, but does not lead the student to the summit. That is instinctual knowledge, which is common to both human beings and animals. It is a gift from nature and has the power to cross the boundaries of past, present, and future. For instance, an animal can sense and record the calamities that are about to happen. Pets sense an earthquake long before it creates a disaster, and they leave their homes and run for safety. Animals remain close to nature and are privileged to utilize this channel of knowledge more than a human being can, because for a human being, there is always a choice in how to respond, and his mind is distracted and dissipated. Man is usually lost in the jungle of thoughts, trying to find out what to do through mental exercise alone. Thus he loses touch with instinctual knowledge. Instinctual knowledge and intuitive knowledge are quite distinct. Instinctual knowledge is the knowledge limited to the boundaries of nature, whereas intuitive knowledge fathoms all the boundaries of nature and leads the sadhaka to the timeless and infinite source of knowledge. Most people do not understand the difference between instinctual knowledge and intuitive knowledge. If someone has a premonition that a close relative is about to die, he is said to be intuitive, though he is actually relying on instinctual knowledge. In the modern world, the distinction between instinctual and intuitive knowledge has been lost, and we think that many people have access to intuitive knowledge when it is really instinctual knowledge. True seekers, aspirants, and sadhakas alone have access to intuitional knowledge. The word sraddha, which is used in verse 31, is an ancient word that refers to three qualities that are explained by this formula. Reverence plus devotion leads to conviction. It is not a faith dependent on belief, but firm faith attained through one-pointed devotion. Sraddha, directed towards one's teacher, is attained by a disciple after long experience on the path. Those aspirants who follow the instructions of the teacher with full conviction are not lost in the conflicts created by the allurements of the world. Those who do not have sraddha, firm conviction in what they are doing, destroy themselves. The aspirants who understand the importance of the teachings given in the 30th verse learn to dedicate all their actions and the fruits of their actions to the Lord of Life and cast off the fetters created by attachment. The ignorant, acting on the basis of fallacious reasoning, remain confused, distracted, and doubtful, and a mind full of doubt causes ruin. Those who are devoid of faith are not fit for sadhana and are therefore unable to attain truth. Such ignorant people see the dark side of everything and waste time in fault-finding. But those who follow their path with full conviction and implicit faith finally attain the highest goal. Such faith is necessary on the path of sadhana. Patanjali, the codifier of yoga science, supports this idea in the Yoga Sutras 1.14. He says that sadhana should be continued for a long time, without any break, and with full and firm faith. Such faith and conviction are essential. Without them, treading the path is impossible. Full conviction is attainment in itself. One should be sure that it is not lost. Maintaining and strengthening faith is the highest state of sadhana. Verse 33.
Sadrusham cheshtate swasyaha prakrutir jnanavanapi. Prakrutim yanti bhutani nigraha kim karishyati.
Even a person with knowledge acts according to his nature. Beings resort to their nature. What can self-control do? Sri Krishna further explains the functioning of the three gunas that motivate one to perform action. He says that it is not easy to fathom the barriers created by the gunas. The relative proportions of the three qualities differ from one individual to another. In one person, one guna is more predominant, while in another, a different guna predominates. These differences are a result of one's past. The words svabhava prakriti, used in verse 33, mean that which is brought forward by births, the inherent nature of a creature. It compels one to act according to his samskaras, svabhava. Thus, self-transformation becomes difficult, and forced methods of restraint do not help. One should therefore not impose such restraints on himself unless he is fully prepared. First, the desire to discipline and transform oneself should be strongly felt. The gunas function no matter how much restraint one practices. That restraint, which is practiced by the ignorant and leads to suppression and repression, is not real sadhana. Mere restraint will not help one to cross the barriers of prakriti. But that does not mean one should cease practicing self-control, disciplining himself, and directing the senses in a controlled way. The practices of self-transformation are different from suppression and repression. Through self-discipline, one develops his positive qualities, and gradually the sattva guna predominates. Sattva is the inherent quality that alone gives the sadhaka power to have a tranquil mind, and that enables him to cross the mire of delusion created by rajas and tamas. For treading the path of faith, one should learn to be detached from the confusion and conflicts created by the constant reasoning of the mind. Scriptural knowledge and mere reasoning are not at all helpful in the upliftment and unfoldment of the sadhaka. It is therefore important for a sadhaka to understand his own nature and, with firm faith, to attain a sattvic state of mind. Verses 34 and 35.
Indriyasyendriyasyarthe ragadveshau vyavasthitau tayorna vashamagachet tauhyasya paripanthinau. Sriyan swadharmo vigunaha paradharmat svanushtitat swadharme nidhanam shreyaha paradharmo bhayavaha.
There are attractions and aversions already facing each and every sense. One should not come under their control, for they are highwaymen waiting for him on the path. Better one's own dharma, even devoid of quality, than the dharma of another, even though well performed. Better to die in one's own dharma. The dharma of another invites danger. The senses respond spontaneously to the objects of the world. Each of the five senses, seeing, touching, hearing, tasting, and smelling, has their objects: color, that which can be felt, sound, taste, and odor, respectively. Each has a distinct mode of perception. The tongue can taste, but cannot hear. The eyes can see, but cannot taste. Each sense has its own duty to perform, and in performing its duty, it flows to its respective objects. When the senses contact their objects, one experiences like and dislike, attraction and repulsion. Ordinary minds react according to those two feelings. Their positive or negative responses to sensory objects keep them from experiencing objectively. That which one person adores is a matter of repulsion to another. Even a sage recognizes something as bitter and something else as sweet, but he does not react like the ordinary person. The sage realizes that it is not the object that causes like or dislike, but one's own prejudices, so he learns to tame both reactions. Sages maintain aloofness. They do not waste precious moments of their life in hating or being attracted to others or the objects of the world. Both lust and hatred obstruct the sadhaka's growth again and again. Once they are known and understood, and their value is reduced to nothingness, they lose their power to influence the sadhaka. Arjuna's wish to remove those objects is evident. Thus, Sri Krishna introduces disciplines in order to help Arjuna perform his duty without being disturbed by those feelings. Existence and duty are inseparable not only in human life, but in nature as well. The sun shines, that is its duty. Likewise, all the modes of nature, such as fire, water, and air perform their duties. In the human body, all the senses and limbs perform their respective duties. If someone foolishly asks the hearing sense to see, he will be disappointed. Therefore, an individual should learn to perform his duty according to his swabhava, the gifts received from his inherent nature. A student can progress on the path of unfoldment by learning to study his inner potentials, for the duty that one performs should be according to his dharma. One is born with certain qualities into a particular environment, and if he does not discharge his duties according to his dharma, but follows the dharma of another, it could prove dangerous and even fatal. If a professor of cultural studies is sent to the battlefield, and a soldier who is trained to be an artillery expert is sent to teach philosophy, both will be unsuccessful, disappointed, and put to shame by others. Therefore, one should learn to follow his own dharma and to discharge his duties and progress as an example for others to follow. The following is a summary of the several kinds of knowledge that have been described thus far. First, there is knowledge that is given to us by our sense perception. On the basis of that, we conceptualize and formulate our conclusions. That is the lowest way of knowing, for the mind remains clouded, and all of the objects perceived by the senses in the external world are ever-changing. Thus, sense perception is inaccurate and inexact. Such incomplete perception comes before the mind for conceptualization, and by the time the clouded mind formulates and concludes, one's experience of the external world is even more distorted. Perceptualization and conceptualization give only a partial and distorted view of the objective world. Another source of knowledge is instinctual knowledge. It also crosses the boundaries of time and space and is able to give a glimpse of the future, but it too is limited. Nevertheless, it has some purpose. Children and animals that are led by this force know many things that are not known by ordinary people. Two other sources of knowledge that complement one another are knowledge through the mind and knowledge through emotion. There is always imbalance if we do not understand the importance of both of these powers. The power of emotion can help the sadhaka by inspiring him and can raise his consciousness to higher dimensions. Bhava, emotion, should not be lost. It is a great help, a force in the path of self-control. The knowledge that flows through bhava is a great force, and there are no interruptions in that flow. But the knowledge that flows through the mind creates many stagnant pools if it is not allowed to go through the filtration of pure reason. Many times, the answers that cannot be figured out by a well-balanced mind are given by bhava, emotion. The stream of knowledge that flows through the mind moves into the many nooks and corners, and because of impurities of the mind, this creates small and big stagnant pools, and thus the stream becomes polluted. The stream of bhava is like a river in flood. It rushes like a beloved running toward her lover who does not care about any obstacles and is not afraid of being caught or trapped. In the stream of bhava, one does not have an enjoyable experience of the path, for he is suddenly transported. He reaches the summit without the experience of the path. The highest of all streams of knowledge is the flow of intuition, which is perfect. Its knowledge is the purest. That flow becomes evident and visible only after we learn that the stream of knowledge that flows through the mind is very lengthy and is full of obstacles. One can get lost on the way. Thus, the aspirant learns to shut the gate that stops the knowledge flowing through the mind and opens the gate that allows intuitive knowledge to flow to its place. Both yoga psychology and modern psychology have shown considerable interest in differentiating amongst people according to personality or character types. As we have already noted, ancient psychologists have divided people into four categories according to their propensities, And that division has unfortunately evolved into the caste system of India. It is interesting to note that Carl Jung also considered there to be four fundamental personality types, and that the types he differentiated parallel to a certain extent the ways of knowing that have been described in the Bhagavad Gita. In Jung's schema, there is the personality type dominated by sensation, the thinking type, the feeling type, and the intuitive type. However, there are some interesting differences between Jung's categorization and the ways of knowing that have been described. For instance, Jung's feeling type is not at all equivalent to knowledge through emotion, as some might think. Rather, it is closely related to the experience of like and dislike, as described in verse 34. The feeling type relates to the world primarily along the dimension of liking or disliking what he experiences. From the perspective of yoga psychology, Jung's intuitive type is a misnomer. What Jung is actually describing is the personality that functions primarily through instinctive knowledge. As we have noted, intuition, according to the yogic perspective, is a mode of knowing beyond the ken of the ordinary human being. Carl Jung also observed that if one does not live in accord with his personality type, but tries to be that which he is not, a neurosis is created. For instance, if a sensation type is forced by external circumstances to live as an intellectual, a severe disturbance will be created in his psyche. Jung's conception parallels the yogic concept of living according to one's dharma. Verses 36 through 40.
Arjuna vacha. Atha kena prayuktoyam papam charati purushah anicchannapi vashneya baladiva niyojitah. Shri Bhagavan vacha. Kama esha krodha esha rajoguna samudbhavah mahashano mahapapma vidyenam ihavairinam dhumena vriyate vanhir yatha darsho malena cha yatholbena avruto garbhas tatha tenedam avrutam avrutam jnanametena jnanino nitya vairina kama rupena kaunteya dushpurena nalena cha indriyani manobuddhi rasya adhishthana muchyate etair vimohatyesha jnanam avrutya dehinam.
Arjuna said, "Now, propelled by whom does this person commit sin, even not wanting to, O Krishna, as though impelled by force?" The Blessed Lord said, "This is desire, this is anger, born of the guna called rajas, consumer of much, very evil. Know it to be your enemy here in the world. As fire is veiled by smoke, or a mirror is by dust, as a fetus is covered with placenta, so is this world of activities covered by desire. It is by this eternal enemy of the wise that knowledge is covered, the insatiable fire in the form of desire, O son of Kunti. The senses, mind, and intellect are its resort. It is by these that it covers knowledge and confuses the body-bearing one." Human beings do not intentionally want to create obstacles for themselves, yet they create them. What instigates the human being to create obstacles to his growth? Why can't he live life free of harmful acts? What is that which compels him to do that which is not to be done? When Arjuna asks these questions, Sri Krishna replies that the knowledge of the three gunas has already been imparted to him. It is rajas, one of the qualities of human nature, that prompts one to commit harmful or evil actions. Rajas leads the human being to be active and to do actions motivated by certain desires. Rajas has the quality of projecting itself onto the external world and thus creates a mirage, delusion, confusion, and conflicts. One's projections become the charms, attractions, and temptations. Those tempting forms are actually part and parcel of oneself, but those alluring qualities have been projected outward by rajas, And one foolishly chases after those mirages, taking them to be real. When one's desire is fulfilled, he becomes proud. And when it is not fulfilled, he gets angry. Pride and anger are two enemies of man. As the clouds hide the sun, as smoke hides the fire, desire obscures the faculty of discrimination, and thereby obscures knowledge, and controls the mind, intelligence, and senses. Whether the desire is fulfilled or unfulfilled, the mind remains in a state of imbalance and abnormality. A man of desires becomes self-centered and isolates himself from the reality of the phenomenal world. That leads him to create his own reality. No matter how many sensory pleasures he experiences, the desires of the selfish man are never fulfilled. The more desires one has, the more discontent he becomes. For when one desire is fulfilled, it gives birth to other desires. For example, if the desire to own a house is fulfilled, the fulfillment of that desire gives birth to many other desires, such as having a better house than one's neighbor's, a nice garden, new furniture, and a swimming pool. Desires are endless. Desire is a canine hunger that is never satisfied or pacified, no matter how much one tries to fulfill it. If one puts fuel into the fire is not quenched but burns more fiercely. Similarly, if one devotes his energy to the fulfillment of sensory desires, instead of experiencing fulfillment, his desires only increase. The wise man understands that desire, which creates misery for him, is produced by rajas. Therefore, he practices to attain sattvic virtues and thus achieve a state of tranquility, which is the nature of sattva. Ordinary people are infatuated with sensual desire, kama. Kama is the prime desire that gives birth to anger, greed, attachment, jealousy, and pride. Wherever desire dwells, one suffers from these other evils as well. The sage knows this and thus always remains vigilant, for desire is such a powerful motivation that it is even capable of blinding the reason of good sadhakas. The senses, mind, and intelligence of ordinary people are controlled by their desires, for when one desires to enjoy sensory pleasures, his intelligence, mind, and senses are externalized, turned outward toward the objects of desire. Sense, mind, and intelligence are the abodes in which the parasite, desire, dwells. If one's intelligence, mind, and senses are not trained, they feed the parasite in the same way that fuel feeds the fire. Desire robs the senses, mind, and intelligence of their energy. But that which is the enemy can also become a friend. When one realizes the grand game being played by the gunas, he strengthens only one desire, the desire to attain the state of equilibrium. Then, instead of being an enemy, that desire is a necessary means. When a sadhaka has a burning desire to attain freedom, he learns to light the fire of knowledge. He bathes in that fire, and all his worldly desires are burned to ashes. The desire for tranquility alone remains. Verse 41.
Tasmatvam indriyanyadav niyamya bharatarshabha papmanam prajahihyenam jnana vijnana nashanam.
Therefore, first control the senses, O Arjuna. Abandon this evil that destroys knowledge and the experience of spiritual realities. It is important to understand here that the battle of Kurukshetra is a battle that is fought in every human heart and mind. Therefore, the historical accuracy of the battle is of no significance for us. Our concern is with the message of the Bhagavad Gita and the way modern man can benefit from its great teachings. We are in search of certain specifics, and this verse explains what the battle is really about, where it takes place, and why it should be fought. Sri Krishna says that desire clouds human intelligence and controls the mind and senses. Therefore, one must learn to have full control of his desires, which are the prime enemy. This refers to the desires that distract and dissipate the energy of the sadhaka. Sri Krishna tells Arjuna to kill that evil desire with the sword of discrimination. Verses 42 and 43.
Indriyani paranyahur indriyebhya param manah. Manasastu para buddhir yo buddhe paratastu saha. Evam buddhe param buddhva saunsthabhyatmanam atmana jahi shatrum mahabaho kamarupam durasadam.
The senses are said to be powerful. Beyond the senses is the mind. Beyond the mind is intellect. The one beyond the intellect, however, is the self. Thus, awakening to the one who is beyond the intellect, holding and supporting the self by the self, destroy this elusive enemy in the form of desire, O mighty armed one. The methods of controlling the senses are concentration and meditation. When the sadhaka desires to attain the highest state of tranquility and to have profound knowledge of the Absolute, his worldly desires are assimilated into that one desire. Thus the outgoing tendency of the senses is controlled, and the mind becomes one-pointed. From here starts the inward journey. The flow of perennial knowledge has its source beyond the body, senses, mind, and intellect. The word para, which means beyond, is used here. Through mere scriptural knowledge, the meaning of para cannot be comprehended, but the sadhaka can easily grasp its meaning through direct experience. The knowledge of the inward journey, which leads the sadhaka from the gross level of consciousness to the subtlemost level, is essential. The word para means the beyond within, not outside. Many seekers interpret the word para in an external sense, but actually it is used here to indicate the levels of consciousness that already exist within us. Beyond the body consciousness is the field created by sense perception, and beyond the field of sense perception is another higher and subtler realm of mind, and then there lies the vast field of the unconscious. But subtlemost is the center of consciousness that lies beyond the unconscious. It is called Atman. The senses command and control the body. All the physical movements remain under control of the senses. The senses, however, are employed by the mind and are directed by the intellect. Over and above all, the self governs the intellect, mind, senses, and body. Having knowledge of the truth that the self is ruled by the self, one learns to follow the path of discipline, which helps him to attain the center of pure consciousness. Verses 42 and 43 are especially important to understand from the viewpoint of sadhana. They show that disciplining the body, breath, senses, and mind is an important requisite that helps one to redirect the flow of energy, consciousness, to its fountainhead instead of allowing it to flow to the objects of the external world and to create more distractions. Worldly desires and an undisciplined mind and senses are great enemies. Worldly desire endlessly breeds more desires. Therefore, such desires should be completely shunned. Here ends the third chapter, in which the message of doing action skillfully is explained.